Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Nicole Fowler, Director of Research for Internal Medicine and Geriatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, who sat down to discuss the use of digital screening technologies amid emerging novel therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease. She provided context on how these techniques will be used, complexities with screening for cognitive decline, and the transition away from traditional methods. Let's dive in.
Demonstration project was a large quality improvement demonstration project where we were looking to see what the feasibility, acceptability would be to do a large scale screening using a digital cognitive assessment tool, the DCT clock by Linus Health, in primary care at the point of care. And so what we did was we actually worked with our primary care sites with IU Health and identified seven sites that were interested in participating. And we actually involved both the providers, the staff, the patient advisory council to help us choose which tool we would use. So actually, they are the ones who actually helped select the Linus tool. So they had a lot of input at the beginning about what that tool would look like. And then we used a method called implementation science or agile science to really figure out the best way of how we would embed this tool in practice. So this, different than a very tightly controlled study, what we did was we ran a series of sprints at each of the sites, where we allowed the sites to actually determine what worked best for them. They knew that the parameters were everybody who walked into the clinic, 65 and older, would be handed the digital cognitive assessment. But was it best for them to have the medical assistant do it at the beginning? Was it best after they roomed the patient? Did they actually do it at the end of the visit? What worked best for both their clinic and their workflow? So we had a lot of really individual processes that we determined with just the main parameters, what we call minimally specified criteria, which is you had to use the Linus tool, since that's what you selected. And then also you had to administer it to patients who were eligible, meaning that they were over 65, they were able to read and speak English, and they had the visual and dexterity to be able to do the Linus tool. So that was really the large kind of scale implementation aspect of the project. And so what we did then over a 12-month period is that we actually tested our ability to do this, where we didn't have a lot of tightly controlled plans and protocols. We did have research assistants who were available to help the clinics if there was staffing issues or if they felt like they actually needed a little bit more support. And so we did have research assistants who would be available for each of the sites to help out. And then what we've done over the past year is we've tested to see how many people were offered, how many patients refused, how many providers said, you know what, this is too disruptive, I can't do this anymore. And then we also, of course, looked at the results. So of those patients who did the digital cognitive assessment, how many passed it? How many had some inconclusive results, meaning we're not quite sure, either based on the fact that they didn't have enough data, maybe they started the test and set it down and walked away. And then those who had a score of potentially impaired and then likely impaired. And so we actually, for the team, had them color-coded red, yellow, and green. And then following that cognitive testing, we put the results into the patient's chart. And again, we allowed the physicians to decide how they wanted to discuss those results with patients. So we also ran a series of sprints at the clinics where providers would actually have a chance to look at the report before they saw it in real life. So they were able to understand that they had a chance to ask questions about the tool, about what the report meant. And then we gave them some information about how to talk with patients about it, so they felt comfortable doing that. And then again, we let them go, and we sort of said, do it how you think is best. And so again, some of the clinics decided to talk with patients at the time of the visit where they had the test done. Others called patients back in. Some are still waiting to talk to them. So it's a whole variety that we'll be following, actually, even after, you know, the next year. So that's really the large aspect of the project. The other pieces that were really exciting that were probably the most innovative was the fact that we then did have a brain health navigator who was available to be a resource for each of the clinics. And so this was an RN who was specifically trained in how to do a initial assessment for reversible causes of dementia. So kind of teaching the primary care team how to look for any meds that the person might be on that could be actually causing some problems. So any anticholinergic meds, are their vascular risk factors controlled? Maybe deciding to run some labs if it's been a while. So really kind of helping the team think through what are the steps to be able to determine if this person actually maybe had a bad day, has something going on, or we're not quite sure and actually would then need a referral. So that brain health navigator also facilitated referrals to neurology, neuropsychology, geriatrics, and then was available to talk with patients if they wanted. So the brain health navigator would both be a resource for the primary care provider and for the patient. And we also allowed them to actually be approached for research. And so the brain health navigator would then, given that everything that we've done so far that I've just described was really part of routine clinical care, we decided that the brain health navigator would also then let patients know that there's any research that they'd be eligible for and provide them with the information for the referral.
You talked a little bit about it in your response, but can you go into a little bit more detail as to some of the complexities and some of the challenges that we have with cognitive screening in primary care settings currently right now?
I think there's three big aspects. So first, you know, is an area that I studied a lot, which is patients' receptivity of the test, right? So, you know, we actually did have patients who refused the test. I'm trying to look right here how many we had. About 54% of the time, it looked like patients actually were offered this and said, no, I'm not interested. I don't want to do this. Or maybe they started it and set it down. So, I mean, that's one thing. And we actually didn't do any sort of prepping for patients. We didn't do any patient education. This was literally like height, weight, here, do your cognitive assessment. So that is one area that I think, you know, was potentially expected, but still like in the area of sort of really understanding what patients think is important with regard to screening for cognitive impairment. I think the second piece is the workflow. So this tool is actually not part of any kind of routine current workflow that the providers have. So they really, you know, in primary care, the delivery of primary care is very tight with regard to time. And there's not a lot of wiggle room to do extra things. And so I think really trying to figure out how could this test be done in a way that didn't take away from other priorities that had to happen for that visit or disrupt the flow and, you know, make patients late, you know, so that was a huge issue. And then the other piece is the sort of the documentation workflow. So, you know, the Linus tool, since we used it as part of the demonstration project, you know, was not a tool that we had been previously using. And so it actually is not embedded into our existing electronic medical record. And so the providers would either need to look at the results as an attachment that either the medical assistants or the research assistants would put into the file. So it wasn't sort of in this very obvious place like, hey, check out your patient screening results. Or they could actually go directly into the Linus website. So if they had a panel of patients that day, they could just keep the website open and look. And so I know that a little bit of both of those happened, but on the other hand, it required some effort and it wasn't sort of easily integrated. And then the third piece I think is not new, but it was interesting that we found it even for this tool. So, and it's this sort of sense that providers are not quite sure they believe the results. So patients who they've had a longstanding relationship with, who they feel are doing just fine, maybe come back yellow or red. And they're like, what? This isn't what I expected. So there was some questioning of the results, which then led to them doing their own tests that they either knew better or felt more comfortable with, you know, sort of a standard paper pencil screening test. And I think in some cases, you know, it did validate what they felt, which was this really wasn't the accurate result. And then others, they had actually helped them kind of think through and put the story together about maybe, you know, they weren't actually sort of seeing all the aspects of the patient that they needed to with regard to their care. And so it did then actually help them understand, you know, maybe that is why their, you know, hemoglobin A1C is not where I want it to be, because there's something else going on with their cognition. So I think those were the sort of three big, you know, both interesting findings, but still the sort of really, really tricky parts of how do we do this systematically and routinely as part of the delivery of care.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Fowler to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, the FDA approved Reverence's daxibotulinum toxin A for the treatment of cervical dystonia in adults, expanding its previous label. Powered by peptide exchange technology, it became the first and only peptide-formulated, long-lasting neuromodulator for patients with cervical dystonia. Its approval was based on results from the Phase 3 ASPEN trial and its open-label study, which included 382 patients and 1,240 treatments over an 88-week time span. Next, the FDA granted orphan drug designation to Avidity Biosciences AOC-1044, an investigational therapy in development for the treatment of Duchenne muscular dystrophy in patients with mutations amenable to exon 44 skipping. The therapy is currently being assessed in the Phase 1-2 Explore 44 trial, with results from the healthy volunteer portion of the trial expected to come in the fourth quarter of 2023. Days later, the European Commission announced the approval of atogepant for the prophylaxis of migraine in adults, becoming the first and only CGRP agent indicated for prevention of both episodic and chronic migraine. The approval was based on data from two Phase 3 trials, PROGRESS and ADVANCE, in which atogepant-treated patients showed a greater reduction in monthly migraine days than those on placebo. Finally, on August 17th, the FDA approved an expanded indication of valbenazine to include the treatment of chorea associated with Huntington's disease. With the decision, the therapy became the only VMAT2 inhibitor approved for the condition, offering an effective starting dosage that can be adjusted according to response and tolerability with no complex titration. Prior to the agent, Huntington's chorea was managed through antipsychotic medications. However, these are off-label and come with associated risks. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Fowler. How will primary care institutions and organizations have to account and plan for these potential therapies, considering the fact that we are an aging society and these therapies are going to be need to administer to patients? So just talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, first I might kind of start off with the fact that, you know, there have been evidence-based treatments for years, but they're not a pill. They are things like collaborative care. They are, you know, support groups for families. They are, teaching and helping caregivers understand how to respond to the disease. So there's a whole aspect of non-pharmacological treatments that, while they haven't actually cured the disease, we know that they've improved the journey. And so I think the first part is to recognize that, you know, we are incredibly grateful for the new findings and the new, you know, pharmacological treatments. And I hope that we have more, and I hope that they become available to everybody. I think on the other hand, you know, there's going to be lots of people who either already have the disease to a point where they would not be eligible, either because their disease is too severe or they have a comorbidity that makes them ineligible for the treatment, and that we really need to sort of make sure that we have that entire pipeline. And so I'm incredibly hopeful for the treatment, and I'll talk about my thoughts on, in particular, how we identify those patients in primary care. But I don't want to sort of lose this concept that, you know, it's it really is a trajectory and a spectrum of care, and that we should be thinking from early diagnosis until death, and sort of how do we actually make every piece of that journey as well lived for the patient and for the family as we can. And we have some of that evidence. It's just harder to do than to give someone, therapy. I think the one exciting piece before I go and answer your specific question is that very soon we are hopeful that Medicare will actually be providing an alternative payment model for dementia, which will actually provide some financial resources and incentives for Medicare Advantage plans and sort of other health systems to really think about a comprehensive plan for how they actually care for these patients from diagnosis until death. So it's really exciting. Regarding the new treatments, I think what's really interesting is that the patients who are likely to be most eligible and be benefit the most from these treatments are really not the ones that we ever see, you know, certainly not in any sort of specialty clinic. Maybe there are people who come in for research, people who feel they have a family history or do have a family history, you know, who are really interested in participating. But most of the people who could be eligible for this treatment are primary care patients who aren't even sure they have a problem. There's no subjective complaints. They have no clinical complaints. They've never sort of thought about, you know, doing a test that uncovers if they have amyloid in their brain. So I think what's important is to be very, very conscientious about how we set up a system that helps us, one, identify the appropriate people, have people understand what the true benefits and true risks are, you know, at that stage, and then really ensuring that it's equitable. Because again, I think that these treatments are oftentimes most beneficial for people who are, you know, not being seen by neurology or sort of not being seen by a specialty, and that we want to make sure that everybody in primary care has access. I think that's going to be interesting to set up. I think the big thing is really, like a lot of things, sort of having there be some responsibility, I think, on the front end, you know, with regard to primary care and even sort of kind of home and community-based services, you know, patients who might already be getting some service at home, but it hasn't been identified that they may have cognitive impairment. And then also identifying what that handoff looks like, because primary care, doesn't have the expertise in being able to do, you know, ordering for, you know, blood plasma, which is going to be a new way to detect it, or PET scans or CSFs. This isn't really something that they traditionally do. So knowing when and who to hand off, I think, is going to be really important. So it's sort of this full collaboration, I think, between primary care and specialty care.
How will emerging concepts like some of these digital technologies and also blood tests, like you mentioned, sort of play a role in the field over the next coming years? Just talk a little bit about the future of that.
I think it's a combination of both sort of efficiency and what people, in particular patients, and I think maybe providers, perceive as objectivity. So, you know, for the most current sort of way that we've been doing diagnosis of patients has been a clinical diagnosis, both history, physical, and then a battery of neuropsychological tests, maybe with some imaging. It's expensive. It takes a series of appointments. Sometimes, you know, being able to find somebody who knows how to do the neuropsychological testing and interpret the results cannot be easy, especially in more rural health systems. So I think what the opportunity for digital tests allow, and also blood tests, is there for it to be a more efficient way to detect who might be at risk. I think the one thing to think about for the digital test is that it's not a diagnostic tool, at least not yet. I mean, it is actually, it's a screening tool. It helps us understand, you know, establish a baseline and understand who actually might need to be referred for diagnostic assessment. So I think it's important because it does potentially add some efficiency in the detection, but it does still have that second piece. The blood test, the plasma test in particular, may have an opportunity to actually be an easier diagnostic test that would determine, you know, who may be eligible for treatment without having access to neuropsychological testing, initially we need that, but maybe eventually that blood biomarker test will be enough to determine who actually would benefit most from therapy. One of the things you may be interested in is that we actually may be starting a grant very soon, fingers crossed, that actually will be looking specifically at how these amyloid and tau assays express in real world populations. So similar to all things as they get rolled out, they're usually tested and validated in populations who are comorbidity free or are not taking very many medications. And so there's been some signals actually that some of these assays do express differently in, say, chronic kidney patients or other patients. And so we need much more data, I think, before we start to use blood as a more ubiquitous test in primary care to see, is it as accurate with primary care or real world patients as it is with the sort of validation cohorts.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.